That's the sound of the singer Nina Simone. She died more than a decade ago, but she's in the news again. A documentary film about her was nominated for an Oscar this year. There's a big Hollywood biopic in the works. But more than that, Nina Simone is inspiring a new generation of young African-American activists. She was a powerful and a political performer. She was also personally volatile. She struggled with mental illness for much of her life, so she was a complicated woman. Music journalist Alan Light just came out with a new biography, which draws on the research from the new documentary film. They're both called What Happened, Miss Simone? Light told Steve Paulson that Nina Simone was unlike any other performer.
Unique is an overused word, but there is something that is so incomparable about Nina Simone that exists outside of category. One thing that I kept thinking about is exactly how unclassifiable her music was. You know, we see her referred to as a jazz singer. People called her the high priestess of soul. She sort of thought of herself as a folk singer. All of these things, there, you know, pieces of these things were true, but there was nobody with this unbelievable range. And I think that made it very difficult to know exactly what to make of her, what to do with her.
And she didn't like some of those designations. I mean, she always rejected that label jazz singer, for instance.
Absolutely. She felt that, you know, if people called her a jazz singer, it was just because she was black. So that was the shorthand. Combined with this, you know, from the beginning, very demanding, often erratic personality that got more and more exaggerated as her life went on and as her own mental and emotional issues heightened. You know, from the beginning, there was this sense that if you went to a Nina Simone show, you know, was she going to show up close to on time? Would she be able to make it through a set without freaking out or yelling at somebody? You know, that very quickly became part of the show.
Well, and she never played it safe. I mean, there was this whole period, for instance, when she was very political in the 60s. And I mean, she was out there, a radical who staked everything on her political activism. And that must have been very unusual for a musician, especially for a black woman to do that.
She could not separate the way that she presented her music, the way that she spoke and acted on stage, from her activism and from her politics. You have to remember her training, you know, her dream growing up, and everything that was focused from her family, from her community, was that she was going to be the first great classical black female pianist. That was what everything was going toward.
And she spent
years and years of training.
Practicing, training. I mean, she was a young prodigy.
She was a young prodigy. She was incredibly dedicated, and that was what everything was pointing to. And I think that what that meant that never went away was this definition of herself as an artist, you know, not as an entertainer. When her classical dream did not pan out and she didn't make the last cut for the conservatory that she was planning to attend, and then she finds herself playing in nightclubs and in bars, she was in this world of entertainment. She was not in this world of art, but she could never let go of that.
Do I move you? Are you willing? Do I groove you? Is it thrilling?
One of the interesting twists in her musical career was she had no training as a singer. She had spent all of those years becoming a classical pianist, and then suddenly she was an entertainer, and she had to sing at that point. And then, of course, that's what we remember her for today, above everything else.
Right. She takes this, you know, summer job playing in a bar in Atlantic City just as a way to make some money and kind of on a whim. She didn't want her mother to find out about it, and that's when she came up with Nina Simone as her stage name.
She had been born Eunice Wayman,
and goes and shows up, plays the first set, and she just plays at the piano through the first set at the bar. And the guy who owns the bar, who she says was, you know, this sort of cigar-chomping, the guy you would think on the Jersey Shore owning a bar, came over and said, okay, that was nice, but when are you going to start singing? And she said, well, I don't sing. I don't know how to sing. And he said, well, either you sing or I'll give the job to somebody else. And so she got up and started figuring out what songs she knew that she could sing and started trying it out. And as you said, of course, becomes a singer unlike anybody that we've heard before or since. But there's this interesting contrast between her piano, which is so trained and so practiced and so developed, and her singing, which really is completely raw and being made up on the spot.
When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige, and brown, Mr. Backlash.
Was there a particular moment that kind of made her so political? I mean, this was the early 60s. A lot of stuff was happening. At some point, she just plunged sort of headlong into the civil rights movement.
Yeah. Once she had moved to New York City, she was, you know, sort of fell in with this black intellectual, black literary scene around the Village with figures like James Baldwin and Langston Hughes and this kind of remarkable flowering of this black intellectual movement. She grew very close to Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote Raisin in the Sun, who sort of became her political mentor. The big transitional radicalizing moment for her was the bombing of the Alabama church and the death of four young girls in, I believe, 1963.
Right, that Birmingham church.
That's right, the Birmingham church. And it was after that bombing, immediately after, that she wrote the song Mississippi Goddamn, which she'd never written a song before, but she just felt compelled. So that was really the line in the sand for her. I mean, her daughter Lisa even says that you can hear her voice changes at that moment. That is, there's before Mississippi Goddamn and after. And she sings in a lower voice, kind of an edgier voice, you know, after she's written and performed that song. It transforms her sound. Certainly it transforms her worldview and her priorities and her actions.
Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last.
And then she becomes a major figure in civil rights movement. She gets to know people like Betty Shabazz, Malcolm X's widow, in fact, lived next door, became a confidant of the black power activist Stokely Carmichael. I mean, she was just right there in the middle of it all.
She was in the center of it, it's true. And there's some fascinating stuff from Andrew Young, who was, you know, obviously one of Dr. King's associates and later the UN ambassador. He talked about how everywhere that you went, you know, Nina Simone was kind of the soundtrack of the movement, that there was no other artist who was as closely identified at every organizing meeting. And when they were going door to door, you know, registering voters or recruiting marchers or whatever it was, that Nina Simone's music was absolutely a constant within that world at that time. And, you know, and then she quickly became a part of more direct involvement, sang at the, you know, at Dr. King's Selma march. Though the first time she met Martin Luther King, she first thing she said to him was, "I just want you to know, I'm not nonviolent." And he said, "You know, well, okay, sister. However, you know, whatever you want, whatever you think."
Are you ready to kill if necessary? Is your mind ready? Is your body ready? Are you ready to do what you have to do to create life?
In the midst of all of this, there's a personal side to Nina Simone's story, and it's complicated. She married a guy who was a former cop who became her manager, and it was a difficult marriage, wasn't it?
A difficult marriage between two very, we would say, strong personalities, I suppose, who, you know, were attracted to that strength in each other and that forcefulness in each other. You know, Andy Stroud was, as you said, he wasn't a former cop. He was a cop when they met. He worked on the beat, walking the streets in Harlem, and instilled fear in everybody in the community. They said, you know, when he would get out of his cop car, you know, people would scatter, they would run from him. And that she liked that, aggressiveness. She liked that macho thing. Once they got together, they made a decision. It was early in her career, but they made a decision that he would leave the force, take over as her manager, and they would focus on her career.
And they became very successful. I mean, he deserves a lot of credit for turning her into a star.
And she was a difficult and a complicated person to work with.
But even before that, I mean, there's this amazing, horrible story about how right before they got married, he beat her up outside on a street after their engagement party. And apparently then took her home in a cab, you know, kept beating her, put a gun to her head, and then tied her to the bed and raped her.
Listen, when you start getting into these unreliable narrators, and there is no question that both Nina and Andy are not entirely trustworthy telling their own stories or each other's stories, it gets very difficult and very complicated to know exactly what was going on. What's clear is, you know, as you mentioned, there was this one horrific incident where he just beat the hell out of her. And the story that she tells and he tells are very consistent, and it's, you know, and it's horrifying. She went ahead with the wedding. They stayed together. Well, you know, how you unravel exactly what was going on while being sensitive to her concerns and trying to be fair to his story, that was something that was very, very tricky for me in terms of writing this book and telling this story.
Well, and part of the complication of this whole story is not just this difficult, very complex marriage, but also what it meant to be a Black woman at that time. And she, Nina Simone, did a song about this for women, which was kind of remarkable.
Yeah, another sort of unprecedented moment was her writing for women. Nobody had really written that kind of self-critique, you know, within the Black community, and writing about not only the struggles for Black women in general, but these kind of obsessions with skin tone and how that leads to these different experiences for different women. There's really nothing to compare a song like For Women to. It's obviously incredibly ironic or enlightening or something to watch the controversy that's going on right now about this fictional Nina Simone biopic that's been in the works for years that's coming out with Zoe Saldana.
Right, who apparently has had her own skin darkened to be able to play.
Her features darkened for the part. You know, the irony of still dealing with those questions and those issues, you know, 50 years after Nina wrote this song is lost on no one.
My skin is black. My arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah.
Nina Simone died in 2003, but she's sort of undergoing a remarkable renaissance right now. I mean, there was this Academy Award-nominated documentary about her, Your Biography, and now this biopic that's about to come out. Why now? Why has she been rediscovered?
There's a bit of a lucky confluence of events, but I think that there certainly is a resonance for Nina Simone and for her work at a moment in the world where, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement has emerged, a sentiment that could have come very directly from Nina. And when there are more artists, whether it's Kendrick Lamar, whether it's D'Angelo, whether it's John Legend and Common winning the Oscar. When they won the Oscar last year for their song from the Selma movie, John Legend quoted Nina Simone in his acceptance speech.
And her song, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, has become a kind of anthem for a lot of young activists today.
These are songs that could have been written yesterday. But I think if there's a legacy, I think it is this sense of her as uncompromising political activist, social conscience. You know, that's where you see these figures like Lauryn Hill, like Alicia Keys, when they invoke Nina Simone, they invoke that sense of blazing passion and unwavering dedication to the fights that she was fighting.
Alan Light's biography of Nina Simone is the companion to the Oscar-nominated documentary film. They're both called What Happened, Miss Simone? Steve Paulson talked with him. Thanks for listening today. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Our producers are Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.